You're listening to episode number 19 of the Secondary Science Simplified podcast. I cannot even tell you how excited I am to get this episode out to you all this week. When I first started this podcast and I was brainstorming the different people I would love to interview for you all to hear from, Jamie Whitlock was one of the first people I thought of, and her interview did not disappoint. Before I get any further into introducing this episode to you, let me first introduce you to my dear friend and old coworker, Jamie. Jamie is a second career teacher. She was in outside sales when she decided to go back to school to become a teacher. After 7 years as a high school biology teacher, she moved out of the classroom and is currently an instructional coach in a large high school in South Carolina. She partners with her teachers and works in classrooms, co-teaching, planning, and modeling lessons. She approaches teaching and coaching with the firm belief that every student can learn and that meeting students where they are and moving them forward not only builds confidence in students, but helps teachers feel successful as well. She is so passionate about her role of developing teachers who go on to impact the lives of students every day, and you are going to hear that coming through in this interview. You're going to learn so much from her in this episode, from her experience in the classroom as a full-time teacher, and now what she has learned from spending the last 4 years in other teachers' classrooms, observing and supporting them. In this episode, we cover her transition into teaching as a second career. We cover teaching a high-stakes EOC-based course, and also working on a team of teachers and how to collaborate with coworkers, even if there are difficult ones on your team or ones not in your subject area, for those of you who are teaching in a small school and you're the lone ranger in your department. She also provides so much wisdom with regards to whole classroom management strategies, as well as garnering respect from students, something that's particularly difficult to do now that we are teaching kind of in a post-pandemic, even though we're still kind of a mid-pandemic classroom setting. She shares her experience working on her educational doctorate while teaching full-time and raising 2 kids, and how earning this additional degree has really opened some amazing doors for her in the educational field. I cannot wait for you to hear from her. I learned so much from Jamie as her coworker and still learned even more from her just through doing this interview, and I hope you will too. I know it's a bit longer than our normal episodes here at Secondary Science Simplified, but I promise it is worth your time to listen to it all. Also, one little side note before we get into the interview. In the spirit of springtime, you may notice some birds chirping away in the background of some of the audio, particularly at the end. It was a beautiful spring day, despite it being the end of February when I interviewed Jamie, and the birds were in full force celebrating the spring weather. So I just wanted to give you a heads up in case at the end of the episode, you're feeling a little like Snow White with birds chirping in your earbuds or your car speakers, that those chirps are in fact in the recording and not in your head. So now without further ado, let's dive into this epic episode with Jamie Whitlock. This is Secondary Science Simplified, a podcast for secondary science teachers who want to engage their students and simplify their lives. I'm Rebecca Joyner from It's Not Rocket Science. As a high school science teacher turned curriculum writer, I'm passionate about helping other science teachers love their jobs, serve their students, and do it all in only 40 hours a week. Are you ready to rock the time you spend in your classroom and actually have a life outside of it? You're in the right place, teacher friend. Let's get to today's episode. Hey, Jamie, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Good to see you.
I know. I'm so happy to see you. And I'm just so excited for my audience to get to know you and to hear from you. So why don't you introduce yourself and just share some of your career history and your teaching experience and all that?
My name is Jamie Whitlock. I have been an educator for 11 years. I'm in my 11th year now. I came to education as a second career. I was in outside sales for 10 years and then needed a change. And we can kind of talk about all that a little bit later, how I came to that and all that. But I was ready for a change. My mom was an educator. So I just kind of started exploring that. And I decided to do high school instead of middle school. So I went back, got my master's and taught for 7 years. In that process, I decided that I knew I wasn't going to want to stay in the classroom forever. I just thought it wasn't going to be enough. So I started to explore going back to school again, and I got a master's in administration and then my doctorate in curriculum and instruction, because I just wasn't sure which direction I wanted to go. And I thought if I was going to do this, I'm just going to do it all, so that no matter what direction I ended up, I would not have a roadblock of not having a degree or some sort of qualification. So I taught in the classroom for 7 years at biology. All 7 years I taught the same thing was biology. And that's how you and I know each other. And then I left the classroom 4 years ago to move into a role as an instructional coach. And I left a very successful high school to go to a high school that was struggling. And I went from a city high school to a very rural high school. And I made those decisions for those reasons. I just felt like it would give me a much different perspective and kind of widen my background and what I'd be able to contribute. And I have been in that role the last 4 years. And I've loved it. And it's just, so the whole education field for me has made me grow more individually, but also professionally because of the choices I've made and what I've been doing.
Right. So back when you originally decided you want to do this career change, did you do your MAT and were you doing that at night while you were doing sales, or how did you, or did you do that full time? How did you balance that transition?
So when I went back, I
had little kids.
Yeah, I did. Well, I had one.
Okay. No, just Charlie.
I had just Charlie, my son. And I think I was pregnant with Livy when I started to question, is this what I want to stay in? Because at the time, that was at the time in the pharmaceutical industry, I was doing pharmaceutical sales, where there was a lot of legislative change and there were a lot more restrictions coming down and our territories were getting better. So I was traveling more. So that's what started the conversation with my husband about, I don't want to be 3 hours away if I need to get back, you know, for the kids. And then summer, you know, when you're thinking about childcare and that kind of stuff, I thought, what am I going to do when they're in school and I'm going to hire somebody to hang out with them all day long? So I just, at that season in my life, I felt like it was, I wasn't loving what I was doing because I felt like I had a lot to say and I was smart, but I wasn't necessarily being treated that way. That was my perception. I felt like I was a glorified UPS person. And I thought, this is not what I want to do. I want to do something more impactful. So education gave me the avenue to do something more meaningful, but be on a schedule that was better for my family. The reason why I shared there were a lot of changes going on is companies every 6 months were downsizing. And so at the time, I was part-time. I was doing a job share. And that allowed me some flexibility while my son was a baby. And then those were going away. And they were starting to say, if you're going to stay in this, you have to go back full time. So they were offering financially, they were offering packages if you would leave. So for me, I was in a situation where I could choose to take the package and go back to school, or I would have to go back full time. So I chose to take a severance package, and it took me 18 months to go back and get my MAT. Clemson had just started a new program. And ironically, I was in the first cohort. There were only three of us. So it was awesome because it was very hands-on. So we were kind of blazing that trail of this new program, and they were looking for people who were just like me, somebody who was older. I was coming to it with a wise decision as far as this wasn't a whim thing. There were reasons behind why I was changing. And I started, I think, a year of my schooling, I was still being paid. So I was in a very unique situation from my severance.
That's awesome.
So there was only a 6 months window there where I was not. But ironically, that 6 month window was when I was student teaching full time. So I had no money coming in. I had to pay for full time childcare. And at that point, I had two. It was like a mortgage payment, but it was just going to be for about 4 months. So, you know, we financially had to prepare for that. And I did take out some of a loan during that time, knowing I was teaching science and knowing that they had that teacher forgiveness up to $17,000. So I knew whatever I took out, it would pay for if I taught for 5 years. So that weighed into some of that. So I had done my homework about that. And so I didn't pay for my master's because of what we couldn't pay for, what we did take out and loan. was covered by that 5-year, you know, teacher forgiveness. And I was in the classroom for 7. So I ended up staying after that. It was easier for me because I was married, because the situation I was in. But there are things in place like that. And if I had gotten into it and had taken out the loan, for at least I knew 18,000 of that would be covered.
So. Right. Okay. So we met, to give my audience some background. Mm-hmm. So you had just finished your first year teaching at the school when I started my first year, even though you were, you know, ahead of me in experience because you had this whole other career and I was, you know, a baby fresh out of college. But we taught biology together, which was really fun. And some of my listeners who are listening are like Lone Rangers. They're the only one in their department. They're a super small school, like I was most recently at. But there are others that are more like where we were, where they're in a large department. You know, there were 4 or 5 of us teaching biology at one time. And so, you know, we were working alongside of a lot of other people. And you and I worked so well together, but we didn't necessarily work like amazingly with everybody else. There, you know, there's a lot of dynamics when you have a team. So I would love to know, what kind of suggestions do you have for teachers who are expected to work with other teachers in their departments? Like, I remember when I interviewed, our admin was like, "This school is all about collaboration and you need to be prepared to collaborate." And I was like, wow, I'm not prepared, but I'm going to get prepared for this job. So what suggestions would you have in terms of doing that?
Well,
you did it for 7 years. Well, you probably worked alongside so many different people as we all kind of shifted in and out.
It was, and there were parts that were years that were easier. Like when you and I worked together, that was easier for me. And not everyone in our group worked the same way. But I think when you can partner with 1 or 2 that are in the group and you are more synergistic and you guys have the same vision, and so it's easier. But I'll say this, I will say, even my most difficult relationships with working with people have taught me something about myself and about others in the work environment that I think I wouldn't have grown as much as a person to be able to be in the role that I'm in had I not worked with people that weren't like you and I. So I think that there's a lot of benefit in that, and you need to embrace it, because I think where teaching has come now is our classrooms are so widely varied, and you are going to have students that get you in the way that you teach, and that's going to be easy. Working with you was easy for me. But you're also going to have students in your classroom that are like some of the other partners that we had that were difficult, and they gave a different perspective, and their value, what you and I valued, was the same, and what they valued was not. And so I think, you know, it really is the same as when you're dealing with your students. And so I would say this, even if the people in your group don't work exactly the way you do, or you don't see eye to eye, in those moments, and something that I've had to learn and I wasn't always great at the time, was really listening and trying to find common ground. Because no matter what differences you bring to the table, if you're teaching the same subject or the same classes, there's going to be some common ground there. And I think you have to start with that and all agree on what you're all going to do together, and then respectfully agree on what you're going to do separate. And knowing that what you offer is going to be different than somebody else. And I think the benefit in doing it that way, and what I see in the teachers that I work with now, is you can have conversations that center around the students and what students are learning. And when you have commonalities among the group, you have a baseline. The differences are what allow you to really look at data, classroom management, what's happening in classrooms, and the overall learning environment, and how that's impacting students in a good way and how that's impacting students in a bad way. For example, we have some history teachers, and where I'm at now, everyone gives common assessment. That was something that we had. And I think that's an easy common ground. If you're teaching the same course and the standards are driving what you teach, everybody should be able to agree upon what is the end result. What do we want the students to be able to do? The roadmap on how you get there can be different, but that end result should be the same. And I think that starts an easy way to start conversation and discourse about, well, here we have this unit assessment. We're all at the end. We're looking at how the students performed. And you can say, here are all the things where the students are doing well as a whole group. You may have an area that they didn't do as well as some of the other teachers. And that opens up to say, hey, how did you teach that? What are you doing in your classroom that maybe I didn't do? Maybe I need to go watch. Maybe I need to try. So I think having differences in a group is more valuable than having a group that's all the same, because at the end of the day, the students are going to get the best of everybody if you are having those conversations and exploring those things. So I think that a collaborative group is so powerful if it's used the right way. Now, if you are a singleton, I think you can still find that in a school. It's just not going to center around your subject. It's going to center around more what you value your classroom environment being. And so you can partner and be like, you know, how do you do transitions? What types of activities do you do? Those kind of, because you can tweak those to fit your content area. It's really going to be more about the learning environment versus the learning content. I think when you're in a collaborative group and you're all teaching the same things, you get to do both.
You're so right. Like, I think back to when I was at this really small private school, and you're right, I was still collaborating, but it was cross-disciplinary. And it was exactly like you said, it was more like, hey, I can't reach this student. What are you doing in your learning environment to reach this kid on a one-on-one basis or whatever? And I love what you said too about you can, that collaboration, it's still good and it's still rich, even when it's hard and you disagree. Mm-hmm. And I love your idea of just having the starting point of the end assessment. Cause I remember loving that, mm-hmm. you know, being able to give a test and be like, whoa, what did I do? Or see like, okay, wait, all of us had a problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's our test. Maybe it's the, and then the other thing I love that we did, I remember, I mean, cause the EOC prep, since biology was an EOC course in our state, was a lot. And I remember we split up the review. So each one of us was doing like something after school. There was something after school basically every day, but then you could go to any teacher. And that was so sweet too, because there were students coming from other people's classes that maybe connected with me, or maybe they connected with you or someone else on our team. And they were able to learn and review with someone else. And I think that's the other beauty of collaboration. Like, students are served better because they can connect with multiple teachers, because you're all kind of running the same race, so to speak.
And I think there's a natural thing that happens in classrooms when you're with somebody, and we were on the 90-minute block for such long periods of time all day, every day, is that there are ways that teachers say things that just don't resonate with you anymore because you've heard it enough. And I think the power in sharing that collaboration, even if it's just the tutoring, is you had laid the groundwork, but one of your students could come to me and something that I said is what turned that light bulb. And so our students are getting fired at so many different avenues of information that sometimes just changing that little bit of the learning environment is all they need to make that connection. And so I think if you're not using, you know, the people that you work with and sharing those kinds of things, it's a missed opportunity ultimately for the students. And it helped, like you said, it helps us all. I mean, I remember going into my first year, going into one of my teachers and saying, can you teach me this topic? Because I am missing the boat. And I just sat and listened to her teach it. And like things that she said, if I went back into the classroom today and taught that, I would still use that. So I think there's power in that too. So I think if you're having difficulty collaborating, there are things that you can start small that then begin, because a lot of collaboration comes from a lack of trust. Like, if there's difficulties, there's a lack of trust there, or there's a competitiveness, which I think happened in our group a lot because some were performing and others weren't. And again, I was driven by the numbers. You were driven by the numbers, but some of our group members were not. And so you have to find what is motivating, just like you do with your students, and figure out how you can do that as a team. And it's hard. It's not easy. And it changes from year to year, I think. But you also, the more you're with a team, as a new person coming in, a lot of your listeners and stuff, if they're new coming in, you're going to be dealing with people that whatever they've done has worked for a while. And it's hard for people to change when they feel like they know something is working. And there, I think there's a fear factor there, but I also think it takes time to build good curriculum. It takes time to deliver information. And so what I always tell my teachers as an instructional coach, my older teachers, is that you no longer know what it's like to be a learner in your classroom, but new teachers and students are learners in their classrooms. And so as our students change, and they've changed greatly over the last 3 years, we have to be open to understanding that the learners in our classrooms don't necessarily resonate with the way that we used to teach. And so we have to be open to that kind of stuff. And I think that's that is a great perspective of an admin or a partner or a instructional coach, is they can provide that perspective of what is it like to be a learner in my classroom? Because I think when you lose sight of that, then you lose sight of your effectiveness on students.
So true. And okay, so speaking of effectiveness, one of the things I felt like you were extremely effective with as a classroom teacher was your ability to manage your classroom. Like, even because, again, when I started working alongside you, it was only your second year, but I just felt like you were extremely advanced in your ability. And I absorbed so much from you and so much from everyone on our team in terms of how to do that. So, and now, especially as an instructional coach, your eyes are on so many classrooms. So I would love to hear your advice for classroom management, either like as a whole, and then also like with dealing with those individual students that are very difficult.
I think classroom management is key to providing a successful learning environment, because you can have the best activities or tasks that you're having students do, or, you know, collaboration. But if there's no classroom management, you lose the learning part of the learning environment. So I think, and I felt this as a teacher, is it's key to the overall success of your students, is you providing an environment where all people feel that they can learn, and where all students feel that they have a place in your classroom. And so I think for me, my perspective as a parent gave me an advantage, because I say this to my new teachers all the time, and I have a child in high school getting ready to have a second child in high school. When you have high schoolers, and I think it starts in middle school. So middle school, this would speak to this too. I think there's more of a care side of middle school, where middle schoolers still really genuinely want their teachers to like them. I think that transfers into high school, but what I see with my own children, is they begin to want to exert this independence. And so as a parent, I don't want you, a teacher, to be my child's friend. That's not what I'm looking for as a parent. I need you to be their teacher. And in order to do that, there has to be safe boundaries on what that looks like. So I say all that to say, I went into setting up my classroom where I wanted guardrails. Like, these are the rules and what we're going to do in here, but I wanted to provide freedom within those. And that's how I explain it. So the second part of that, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, but the second is, students, especially high schoolers, want to push boundaries. It's a natural, age appropriate thing that happens. And I think that when you don't provide clear expectations, they come into your classroom. Can I have my cell phone out? Are we allowed to do this in here? Can I do this in here? That's what's going through their mind, instead of focusing on what you're trying to learn that day. So I think you have to have very clear expectations, which are your guardrails, but you have to allow some flexibility for the students within that class period. So those guardrails for me were, how do I hand out papers? When do you sharpen your pencils? What does it look like if I'm doing direct instruction? What does it look like if we're in an activity? Like, everything you can think of was spelled out. And I went over it, and I stayed very consistent with my expectations and with what our procedures were. Because I think if they knew when they walked in the door, their papers were going to be laying right there for them to collect and go to their seat. They knew if I were taking up papers, there were only going to be two ways that was happening. They were either bringing it up to me, which was a test or something that was graded, or that it was all going to be passed forward. They knew that when we went to, you know, spread out time, that they could get up and they could move and they could take their computers and they could take their stuff, but they had a certain amount of time. And when that time was up, they were coming back. So I think that it's all in your routines and spelling all of that out. At the beginning of the year, I handed out, and it was an entire page, What do I do if I need to sharpen my pencil? How do I turn in a paper? What do I do when direct instruction is happening? How do we do partner work? I mean, everything was spelled out. And so I think you remove the what ifs for kids. So the behavior is explicit. And there were times you would have to reset, say, wait a minute, this is not how we do this here. But if you stay consistent to that, they learn those patterns. Students are very flexible and they're going to do what you allow them to do in your room. So that to me is on you explaining what your expectations were. Down to Rebecca, it was about respect. I would say, I will respect you. I need you to respect me. So when I say I want you to respect me, this is what this looks like. When I am going through direct instruction, you're not having a conversation. When I say up on the board, there are no cell phones out today, there are no cell phones out. And if yours is out, you're just going to have a referral. But I mean, going through, if this situation happens, this is how I handle it. If this situation happens, this is the consequence on the front end. So they already knew. And I think that saved a lot for me. But what that did is that set up the classroom to allow me then to get to know the students, because I wasn't focusing on, hey, I need you to be quiet. Hey, I need you to sit down. Hey, I need you to do that. They already knew that they weren't doing that or what was expected. And then you can focus on getting to know the kids, because that's where the meaningful learning happens. They want to do well for you, or they enjoy being in your classroom, or being in your classroom is almost relaxing to them because they already know what the expectations are. So I would say that is where I thrived in that, because I was very consistent and I was very explicit about everything in my classroom, like where, even down to where you put the scissors. I mean, like, and they knew that. So it just, I think taking the time at the beginning of a semester to really focus on that saves you time and energy as you go on. That's part of it. I think the other part of the classroom management, and I'm a true believer in this to this day, is students are successful when the school, the teacher, and the parents are working together. So, and you and I did this, and not everybody in our group did this, but every Friday, I sent out an email about everything that was happening the next week, like the topics that we were learning, any assignments that were going to be due. And it didn't take me maybe 5 minutes to do it, because I could send it out to everybody at once. But it was a piece of the classroom management that I think was a game changer, because when I had to have conversations with parents, they already felt like they knew what was going on in my classroom. And so it was a lens into what their students were learning, what the expectations were. There weren't very many surprises that would happen. If I ever changed anything, it was always giving the student more time, never less time, you know? So those kinds of things, I think, make a big difference, because then everybody is in that communication loop. And I will tell you, as a parent of teenagers, they don't communicate well, and they can communicate to a teacher very well, but they don't necessarily do it to you at home. And again, that's a natural progressing. They are trying to exert their independence, so they're not always sharing. So being able to be a voice for parents to say, hey, I heard you were learning this in class, it opens that conversation. So they knew if something happened in class, their parent was going to hear about it, because I had already made those connections with the parents. So I think that was key too, to be honest with you.
You're so right. I have said so many times to my husband, like, when I can get back in the classroom, when I don't have these tiny humans at home with me, I will be such a different educator now with the perspective of being a parent. Like, mm-hmm. I really do think that changes, because I just couldn't think of that third part of the triangle that you just right. mentioned, because I didn't know what it was like. But now that I even have tiny kids, any update I get from their like preschool, I like want to know. And I'm like, I can't imagine for having older kids. And then another thing I want to say is I love what you said about the classroom management. That's something I talk about a ton, is being proactive, so you don't have to always waste energy being reactive. Mm-hmm. Because I know for me, I would have like emotional responses. And then it would feel so personal to the student, and then they feel attacked. Whereas like, if you set out the expectation and then you're just executing what you've already told them, it takes the emotion out of it and it doesn't feel personal for them or you. So I love that you said that, even though it can sound like very anal and overly type A, but it really does save energy for everybody. And I love how you use that as an illustration for how students could respect you. So I would love to hear, what are ways that you show respect to students? Because I feel like the respect thing is something that has changed so much in the last like 5 years of education. Like I feel like even 5 years ago, there were still a lot of students that were raised like you just respect authority. And then, right. you know, some teachers lost it. But now I feel like students are so skeptical. Like they walk into every room and have no, like you have to earn their respect. So how do you do the other, how does that other side play out? And how have you seen that where we can
respect students? It's really super hard. And I will say that the respect, even when you set boundaries in a classroom, you're going to have off days. And that was always something that I said to the students. So I would say part of showing respect is I would say there are going to be days that I may do something that upsets you, or you may do something that upsets me. We're all going to have bad days. And that's the realism of being in a classroom together for an hour and a half for 90 days. So if you're having a bad day or something is going on, you don't have to share. But if you need a timeout, you need to communicate on your way in. Today's not a good day. I just need to be left alone. You know, and we're all, if that becomes a consistent issue, then that's a whole different thing that you have to address. But I think just setting up an environment where it's okay to have a bad day, because we're going to have it. And there were times that I would be reactive and have to say, you know what? I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have reacted that way. I did. You have to be willing to apologize and own when you make a mistake to a student. I think that's so meaningful to them because you're going to do it. It may even be in the way that you grade. I mean, I had students that would say, well, I don't understand, you know, why you graded it this way. And I'd be like, you know what? You're right. You deserve. So you have to be willing to be open to them pointing out that you're not always right. And that's okay if it's done in a respectful way and you receive it that way and you say, you know what? You're right. And you give them that. But in today, I will say I deal with this a lot because I'm kind of quasi admin. I mean, I guess I'm an administrator in a school, but I don't deal with discipline on a regular basis. So what I think I'm seeing is there's just when we all went out on COVID and you were with your students more, people were working or they weren't working and they're used to their student being gone. I think it changed some of the relationships that students had with adults because I want you to think about it. Most of the day during the week, parents and students weren't together. So they weren't managing their relationship. They were managing at home and on the weekends. That's a lot different than when you're with somebody all day long and you're having conversations about, are you doing your work? Are you staying on top of this? What about this? What's happening in that class? And there were some students who were getting none of that at home and their parents didn't care if they were doing their. So all of that is a perceptive piece that students are now picking up on. And they're like, you know, maybe when they were at home, they were telling their mom, I've done my work, get off my back. Or they were, why do you, you know, I don't care about school. You didn't ask me one time about anything I've been doing. Who cares if I'm failing? You didn't tell me I needed it. So I think the dynamic of where school fell in the conversation changed so dramatically that now we're back and we're trying to set those boundaries and kids have a different perspective on what role school plays in their life. If you have a home life where school is a valued thing, those students are still going to be value what teachers bring to the table. If you have a situation where that is not a valued part, we had lots of students at our school that started working full time. So what became the value is the money they were bringing home, no longer what they were school. So I think that perspective has changed. And until something happens in that, you're going to fight that because now you took a student whose family valued them bringing that money home more than they did what they were learning and told them they can't do that anymore. And now you got to go sit in school again. So it's a society problem. And I think at the end of the day, you can't resolve that. So what you can do in your classroom as a teacher is try to open those lines of communication. And you have to be realistic that there are kids in your classroom that don't value at all what they're learning. So I think more than ever, there has to be intentional, purposeful planning for what you have students do in your classroom. And I think that's how you build respect. Like if you're in my classroom and we're working on something, that is going to help you do better in my class. That is going to help you do better in the test. That's going to give you some sort of skill that is valuable. I think we have to change our perspective to the actual learning part is not what people value anymore. It's what are they getting from it?
That's such a great point. I love what you said. I mean, so many things you said, but I love what you said about showing respect by seeing them as an individual and being humble enough to say, I'm going to have bad days. You're going to have bad days. Like, that's okay. Let's make sure we know that so that we can, I'm not going to push you on a day that you're just having a bad day, you know, or whatever it may be.
And be realistic to like, there are going to be kids. And I always said this, I said this to you a lot. And I say this to teachers now. I wasn't as a biology teacher trying to pump out a million neurologists. That's not what my job was. My job was to get these kids to the next level of whatever they were wanting to do. And I think that it's not personal if kids don't like what you teach. At the end of the day, it's your job to get them to what they are going to do next. And I think we have to remove that part of it. And that gets back to what you're saying. There's going to be good days. There's going to be bad days. There were times that I would look at kids and be like, I know you're never going to use this again, but we have to learn this to get to this next point. So I think you just being very real about those kinds of things is what builds respect. I think a lot of times, because in high school, especially, your content is very specific. You are teaching it because you like it a lot. And again, you lose perspective of the learner in your classroom if you think everybody thinks the same way you do, because they don't.
Yeah, that's so true. We taught together biology. And like you said, like sometimes there were things we just had to teach because it was on the EOC. And you know, that's not fun, but we have to admit that, like, okay, part of our job was to get these pass rates. And we, as a school and as a department, had unbelievable pass rates. So kind of shifting gears, because I do think this could be helpful because there are so many people who listen who teach biology, because biology seems to be an EOC course in a lot of states. So how did we have such good pass rates where we were?
Well, I think there were several things that we did that I think don't happen in a lot of schools, and it wasn't happening in the school that I moved to, that is happening now, and we're seeing a lot of success. So I would say the common assessment is huge, because you're all agreeing what the end result is. But those common assessments, what we were so good at, Rebecca, was we knew the standards inside and out. And down to the point that we use the language of the standards and what the way we were assessing the kids. So like, if they were asking them to be able to compare and contrast our activities and the way we presented the information and what in any type of task we wanted the kids to do, they had to be able to do that, compare and contrast. Like, we aligned what we taught in our classrooms so specifically to what the standards said. I think that is number one why our kids were so successful. Because what I see and what I've seen in a lot of schools in my role is teachers like to teach what they want to teach. And so, especially in biology, they go to such depth. In that year one biology class, it is not necessary to do that. It is better to build a solid foundation of the basics than it is trying to teach. And what I hear all the time from teachers in all the high schools when I go is, well, I have to prepare them for AP bio. No, you don't. That is not your job. Your job is not to prepare students for AP bio. Your job is to teach the standards that are in front of you. And I think when you do that and you do that well, they will have a solid foundation to do the AP bio and to go into that depth. And so I think we constantly feel like we have to do the next level, but that's not, when you're teaching an EOC course, the number of kids that are actually going to go to that next level are a minimal percentage. So you have to be fair to all the kids. And where we taught and in our state, it is a gateway course. So no course counts as a lab science until you pass that biology. So are we being fair to the kids by expecting that kind of a level? Like, you have to be honest about that, because it's not, and I think that it all comes back down to the standards. We taught to the level of the standard, and they knew it, and they knew it well, and they knew it inside and out. And that's where we spent our time, not on all the extension. And the extension came in the honors, but I would say this, it did not change our AP bio pass rate by cutting down what we cut out. We were just so specific, you know? So I think at the end of the day, you have to do what's right for the kids. And what's right for the kids is to teach exactly what they're going to be tested on. And, you know, a lot of people, and there are going to be people listening that are like, oh my God, I have to teach to a test. And unfortunately, where I have evolved on that is we don't make the rules, and legislatures have decided that this is how that they think learning should be. I don't like it. I wish there was a lot more flexibility. But if that is going to be 20% of my kids' grades, I'm going to do everything I can every day that they're in front of me to give them the best opportunity to get the highest score, whether I think it's fair or not, right? Because it's 20% of their grade. So we did teach to the test because we taught the standards and we taught them well. That's what I would say. And I think the other avenue of why we did so well is because it wasn't just about the test. We were giving them thinking strategies and ways to maneuver. We had lots of tasks where kids had to problem solve and do those. And so we built all of that into our curriculum. And I think that's the other piece, is that it was about making sure we focused on the standards and providing skills for the kids. And so we really were teaching processes and content.
Right. Okay. So that was super helpful, but I'm going to switch gears now. So yeah, you eventually decided that you wanted to earn your doctorate, and you did your master's in admin too. So I want to know more about that. Like what you did. I know you did it while you were teaching full time.
Yeah.
So how did you manage that? How did you had kids at home too? So you're balancing all of that, you know.
It was super hard. I'll be honest. I don't really know how I did it. You know, when you get into something and you're focused, and I am one of those people who likes to have goals. So I just knew staying in the classroom, teaching biology, and because I was good at it, I knew I was never going to get out of it. Like I always was going to be the one who was going to be teaching it because I performed in that area and schools are graded by that. So I just knew I was not going to get a huge flexibility. And so I knew that that was not going to be enough for me. So I started to explore. And at the time, these programs are everywhere now, but at the time it was kind of just getting started. Again, I was in the first or second cohort. I did an EDD out of University of South Carolina, educational doctorate in curriculum and instruction. And my focus was higher ed leadership. But I did my research on technology integration into the classroom. And so I kind of hit so many different avenues with that, that it kind of set me up to have choices, which is what I wanted. I did it because I wanted choices. It was a 3-year program. Some classes were online. I had to go to Columbia several times through the dissertation process. That now has changed. It's all online. I think Clemson has one online now too. That's the same thing. It's an EDD. I think it is, when you look at educational doctorate, it is more about practical use in a district in the classroom. That is why I chose that route. Because it was a second career, because I was adding this on, I would never leave to go teach at a university full time. I wanted to stay with my hands in the field. So that's why that one was just a better fit for me. Now, can I adjunct with that? Could I pick up classes? Yeah. And I do that now. I teach a graduate course on disciplinary literacy and I love it. That I wanted as options for my next phase of life. When I start to slow down, I could just adjunct here or there. And I have the I can do that with that degree. I could go be a superintendent if I wanted to with my doctorate, or go into the academic side of a district, which is what I wanted. I wanted that flexibility if I decide I want to get out of a school building and do more on that level. So that's why that degree was the best fit for me. And I will say I had to be very intentional. I had 2 kids in elementary school and I chose to do it then because we could control their activities in our time at that age. Where I am now, it would be 10 times harder because I don't have control over their, you know, their swim meets and this and that. So it was really hard. So that is why I chose to do it then, first off. Second off, I had to set clear boundaries. Monday through Friday was schoolwork, my job. Friday night, Saturday, Sunday was my doctorate. So I did all my grading, any of the stuff. So I was working every night. Sometimes I would do some coursework during the week, but I tried to mainly focus during the week on my job and on the weekends. So when I say the weekends, I would leave my house at 8 a.m. on Saturday, and I would not come back until 5:30, and I'd be working. So I was very removed. The first year was not that bad. It's the second and the third year, those 2 years where you're doing a lot of your writing and your research, that I was very removed from my family dynamic. Something was going to sacrifice in that, and that's what sacrificed. But we felt long-term, it would give me more options for that. And so I don't regret doing it. I was burning the candle on both ends. It took me probably a good year after finishing to totally decompress, because I was constantly doing something. There wasn't any downtime. So it's a hard thing to do, but I'll say this. I don't think there's ever a time that it's going to be easy. So you just have to manage it. When the opportunity came to me out of nowhere, I felt like I needed to take it. I did. We made it through it, and I don't regret it at all. So it was a lot of hard work, but I think it was very worth it.
No, I'm grateful to hear, because I think a lot of us sometimes can feel stuck in our role as like a high school educator. And so I think it's just helpful for listeners to be able to hear kind of what you can do and kind of how you can expand in this role and kind of do some other things. So doing that has been worth it. And I love what you said too. I never would have thought about that, how it makes sense with the kids in elementary school versus now where their evenings and stuff are so busy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really, really wise. So, okay. What do you enjoy most about your current role, and how have you just enjoyed it?
Yeah, I love being an instructional coach, and I'll tell you why. It has made me, you know, if I went back into the classroom, I'd be 10,000 times better of a teacher, because the one thing that stinks about being a teacher is you don't know what's happening outside of your own classroom. And so this perspective that I have been able to gain has been phenomenal. I mean, I'm in classrooms all the time. I've done coaching cycles in history, in English, in Spanish, like modern languages, algebra, co-taught algebra. And when I do coaching cycles, I'm in the room with the students every week. Sometimes I teach lessons. Sometimes I do small groups. And so I'm very ingrained in the process when I'm doing coaching. And it has provided me such a unique perspective about how different your content areas are. So being in the way that you approach things and the different things that we all struggle with are different depending on our content areas. And I think schools still prescribe a lot to that one size fits all, and it really needs to be. And we have really tried to be very content specific, because what somebody needs in English is not going to be what they need in science or math. And so you have to be very true to the discipline at that level in high school and to the skills that are being taught in those classrooms. And I think this role has allowed me to see all of that, which has been amazing. And I can be that bridge to say, hey, we did this in this class. I don't know if it'll work in your content, but maybe we could tweak it and try it. That creative part, you get stuck with your blinders in your world. And I think that has been phenomenal. I think the other part is I've always kind of been a problem solver, but now you look at things on such a larger scale, like choices that you make in a school leadership. How does that impact not just this particular group, but the whole, you know, the whole building? And what does that look like for teachers across disciplines and stuff? So it has given me such a different leadership perspective being in this role. And it's hard. And the transition going from in the classroom in front of kids every day to what happened with COVID and the learning curve with that to now being back. What does that look like? I think we're all still trying to figure out really what is the role of the teacher in the classroom. And you know that the number one success rate of a student in the classroom is the teacher. So it's the teacher, but how do you leverage all these things that we have now to provide the best learning environment? And so I think we're all still trying to figure that out. And I think there was a big learning curve. And so I think what we battle now as an instructional coach, it gets back to what you asked me about, is the respect level, the value of what you bring to the table. And I think some of that was so misconstrued because nobody has ever taught in a pandemic. And so what parents were seeing was such a huge transition that we were all making on the fly. And so I think that lack of confidence in what's happening in buildings, and I think that that new interest in, you know, we need to have more say in what's happening in school buildings, that all comes from what people were perceiving in the middle of a pandemic, you know. And so I just think there's going to be a lot of change in education over the next 3 to 5 years to figure out what does this model look like now? And being in a building all day isn't going to be right for all students. So what do you do with that and that kind of stuff? And I think those are the things that this role has allowed me to begin to explore. And then where I go next, whatever I decide to do, I think would be to further those things. Like, what are we going to do to really help kids be citizens that are providing for their communities? Because there's a lot that aren't right now.
Absolutely. It really is crazy how much transition there's been in the last few years. And every, like you said, we're all just kind of figuring out on the fly. And it's going to be a great sociological investigation down the road to like look back and see how this has all impacted society. But yeah, it's been really wild. So I guess in this, my last like serious question for you, then I have a fun question, but how then can teachers partner with instructional coaches like you to get some support in this new season of education and that's constantly changing? And we're trying to figure out what are we doing?
You know, I think if you have an instructional coach in your building, the best thing you can do is have them come in, and I call it eyes on students. Watch what the students are doing and tell me what they're doing, because what you perceive is happening in your classroom is not always what's happening. Number one, I think under getting a different perspective, when a students are freezing, when you give directions, and the students are like, wait a minute, what am I supposed to do? Like, what is causing those roadblocks? Is it a lack of knowledge, or is it the way that you explain what you want the kids to be able to do? So that's what I mean, really drilling down to like what actually happens in your classroom and those kinds of conversations, and really setting up tasks that everything that you give the student in the classroom enables them to do that particular task. So being so purposeful in your planning, and that takes time and that takes conversation. And sometimes that takes somebody else being in there and saying, you had 3 students over here that were completely lost. What were they not able to do? Where were they in that? And it's hard to do that by yourself. So I think, you know, having somebody come in and just really watch kids is a good perspective for you to see of what's really happening. Because if you're in the front or even walking around, there are other kids who are doing other things. And so trying to get a good idea of what's happening in your classrooms, I think is very powerful.
I think so too. I love that with like the second set of eyes. It makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Okay. So last but not least, I like to ask every guest I have, if you would share one way that you have simplified your life recently, and it could be school related or not, it could be a life hack, an organizational tool, it could be anything. So what's one way that you have had a more simplified life recently?
I meal plan more than I ever have. And I don't do running trips to the grocery. Like, we order online, or I make a list and I set the menu for the week. And like today, when I get off with you, because I'm off today, I'll go ahead and meal prep several things that don't have to be cooked fresh, so that I have more time in the evenings to just be present and I'm not in the kitchen doing stuff. Because when you have 2 teenagers that are constantly eating, it's nonstop. So it is, between that and the laundry, it's overwhelming. So that, you know, meal prepping to me, it takes time on a Sunday, but it saves me so much time. And I meal prep my lunches for the week. So in the mornings, I save time because I'm not packing a lunch. In the evenings, I save time because I only have to do one part of the meal or whatever. So I would say I would do that. And I would say this season of my life, having 2 teenagers and almost 2 in high school, I have a driver now. That's been a huge game changer. So that extra time that I now have where I wasn't driving, I didn't. So this might be a second one, but I didn't fill with coming home and sitting. I now twice a week go to a bar class at the 4:30 session, which 4 years ago, I would never have made plans at 4:30, but I'm like, better off at swim. I'm doing this for myself. I have certain times where I have time where I focus on, a group of us are reading the whole Bible in the year, Bible in the year. So I have now a certain time that is set aside just for that. So I think really being intentional about, there may be things that seem time consuming, but if they're relieving other stuff throughout the week, it makes it so much more relaxed here. And then as your seasons change in your life, be very cognizant, because I didn't do this when I was going through my doctorate and all that. And when your kids are little, you're giving so much of yourself for their existence. You don't want to continue to do that as they get older. I have tried to transition into, I am making time to fill my soul with the things that I need so that I can be more present and better for them. So I think that's what you have to do. I see so many friends, it's like when they got 30 minutes, they come home and they sit. I'm trying to fill that with things that are going to fill my soul, because we don't, as mothers, as teachers, we don't fill our own boxes. We fill everybody else's. And I think the last 2 years and what COVID taught me is I have to fill my own spirit.
I love what you said about seasons, because it's so true. Like, I feel like I used to work after bedtime all the time because that was the only time I could work. Now I'm in a season where I can work. I can send my kids to school, preschool, you know, whatever. Or like you said, when you had your getting your doctorate, that wasn't the season to go to a bar class. Like,
no,
it's fine. You know, maybe that wasn't like the your best body you had for 3 years, but who cares? Because now you're in a season where you have that capacity. And so I think that's so important for teachers to hear, to give themselves grace that like whatever season you're in, it's okay to have a certain capacity now that may be really limited, because maybe that capacity is going to change in the future.
And I think it should change, because if you're growing as an individual, as education has changed, the needs for my soul have changed, you know, and as your family changes, that changes too. And if you aren't present in your classroom, you're missing so much of why everyone gets in to do this. So you have to give yourself grace and time to shut it off, to get away from it so that you can be present, so that you can be the best that you can be when you're in there.
I literally could not agree with you more. And I think that's the perfect place ending to end. So thank you so much.
This was so fun.
You just covered so many things. I'm so grateful. And thanks for sharing some of your time off to talk with me.
Yeah, we'll do it again anytime.
Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you learned as much as I did from my interview with Jamie. If you have questions for Jamie, shoot me a direct message on Instagram at its.not.rocket.science, and I will give you her email address so you can reach out to her directly. She has given me permission to do that with you all, and so I think that was so generous of her, and that's how I can get you connected with her. And before I let you go, I do want to encourage you to click the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss out on any episodes coming up. Because next week we are starting a new series all about how to end your school year strong in order to set yourself up for success next school year. And I do not want you to miss it. So be sure to follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. All right, teacher friends, that wraps up today's episode. If you're looking for an easy way to start simplifying your life as a secondary science teacher, head to itsnotrocketscienceclassroom.com/challenge to grab your classroom reset challenge. And guess what? It's totally free. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll see you here next week. Until then, I'll be rooting for you, teacher friend.